The John White theme. Good morning, John.
Morning, Steve. With that song, it reminds me that after the holiday week of racing in Santa Anita that lasted through yesterday, one of the things I have to do today is change the litter boxes. So
I love it.
Not to mention heading out to the store to buy more cat litter. So
there you go.
The song served as a very good reminder.
I love it. Well, and you remind that we did have holiday racing. I really haven't talked much about yesterday. Of course, Lucullen for Kieran McLaughlin and the Knickerbocker. Santa Anita did not have stake action. But on Saturday in the distaff, the Cal distaff just grazed me. Nick Alexander, there he is again. Can't say no. And Giovanni Franco for Phil D'Amato. And then Lacuthia won the Enochia on Sunday. Peter Miller and Abel Cedillo. But really, I think, honestly, the most important performance of the weekend at Santa Anita got to be Honor AP.
Very impressive win, and of course, anytime I see an offspring of Hollywood Story, I immediately think of you being the big Hollywood Story fan that you are, and it looks like Hollywood Story, a multiple grade one winner, has produced a very nice two-year-old here, a Ridgeling by Honor Code, a grandson of AP Indy, and boy, you know, I was extremely impressed with that debut run sprinting. Boy, you could just really see the tip of the iceberg there. And they took their time with him, didn't rush him back, a couple months off, and stretched him out, which it looked like was going to be something that he would really like. And I was really impressed by the fact that in his debut he was so far back early this time. He came out of that gate and came out very nicely, very professionally, really. And it looked to me heading into that clubhouse turn that Smith really would have preferred not to even be on the lead, but he couldn't help it. That Honor AP just, it wasn't like he was dragging him there or anything, but Smith wasn't going to restrain him to take him off the lead. And for him to come home as nicely as he did, I mean, he just drew off so beautifully in the lane and gets a 91 buyer. So he goes from a 77 in the debut to a 91. Steve Anderson of the Racing Form, who does such a good job reporting, a job that I once did here in Southern California for the DRF, he pointed out that that was the fastest time of 12 races at the meeting at 1 mile on the main track so far as the raw time, 137.94. So you had mentioned in a text immediately after the race, you thought, wouldn't the Los Alamitos Soterity make sense? Steve Anderson also reported that is exactly a race that they are contemplating for Honor AP, and they did say no Breeders' Cup for Honor AP. So they are thinking of the Los Alamitos Soterity. That would just seem to fit wonderfully from a timing standpoint, and that race has really been so good through the years as a springboard into a three-year-old campaign. So it looks like a really bright future here for trainer John Sherris, one of the best trainers I've ever been around. And it looks like he's going to be really primed on the Derby trail here with Honor AP.
Well, and we talked last week to John, and I'm kind of glad that we've connected a few weeks after my initial, and I think it was in September at the end of Del Mar, I reached out to John a couple of times, and we just didn't connect. And so then that morning last week, he responded. He said, sorry, okay, all right, if you insist. And he was tremendous. And we
as
got
usual.
Him out, you know. Yeah, he's you know, it's funny. There's so many of the horseman visits that, you know, always seem to resonate. And John's on that front, Shug. How about Barkley Tagg last week, too? I mean, Barkley, I thought, was really informative and insightful.
That was just fantastic. And another, you know, to me, positive sign coming away from this Honor AP performance, you know, that was a pretty highly regarded race in terms of prospects.
Yeah, it's a good group.
And Tears Magician finished second for Richard Mandela. And you look at it and say, well, yeah, he kind of got his clock clean getting beat by a little over five lengths. But Tears Magician was over 10 lengths in front of the third-place finisher in that race. And as I say, it was not considered a weak race going into it. So it's just further evidence to me that what we very well are dealing with here with this Honor AP. I just he's the kind of two-year-old to me that is just so exciting.
Yeah, no, this is what we're after. Once the summer and you know, they start to parade through, we get to this juncture and it starts to get interesting. We from a race standpoint, John, one other thing I think I'll slip in here as I look at yesterday's results, the natural hat trick for Doug O'Neill yesterday, the fifth, sixth, and seventh race. And, you know, I, for those that heard me last week, I think on Friday, I'll just keep reiterating that Doug O'Neill deserves the absolute 100% support and appreciation of the industry. He more than any one individual from within the industry has been leading this, you know, these proactive, I don't want to call them protests so much as demonstrations and rallies before big days at Del Mar and at Santa Anita. And with the help of Oscar De La Torre, I cannot congratulate and voice enough support for what Doug is doing. And so for him to be rewarded on the karma front, as Hammer famously refers, karma is king, and the good karma swinging around to Doug right now. I also got to mention, it looks like a step forward for a three-year-old, Samantha Siegel's quality road filly that was bred by Martha Mulholland. That's Road Rager.
And that was a nice looking win for sure in that race. And you mentioned O'Neill. You know, he's always been such a terrific ambassador for our game, honestly. You know, you think of the controversy that was involved back in the day with Al Have Another, and he handled all that, I thought, extremely well heading to the Belmont. And, gee, what a disappointment. You know, I really think Al Have Another, I had a few, after the Kentucky Derby, I bet on him to win the Belmont Stakes in a proposition in Las Vegas where they say, will there be a Triple Crown winner, yes or no? And this was before the Preakness, but it was after the Derby, and he was such a lightly regarded horse. He, in fact, of course, wasn't even the favorite in the Preakness. Bodemeister was. And then headed to the Belmont, was the morning line favorite. And to me, Union Rags, who won the race. But considering the final time and so forth, I just really feel if Al Have Another had had his chance, he would have won the Belmont. But we'll never know that. But like I say, such a disappointment. And both Doug O'Neill and Paul Redham handled that with such class. And, you know, I remember being up at Emerald Downs in the early 2000s for the Long Acres Mile Pacific Northwest major race, and I was there to do the Fox Northwest telecast along with Joe Withey and others, and I remember that Doug O'Neill was sending up a horse from Southern California for the race by the name of Skyjack, and actually he won the race, broke the track record. And Doug O'Neill actually gave me the two front shoes that Skyjack wore in that race. But I remember the people at Emerald, in the publicity department especially, saying, do you know this Doug O'Neill from Southern California? I said, well, yes, of course I do. They said, what kind of guy is he? I said, believe me, by the time he leaves here, Everyone here at Emerald will love this guy. Trust me. And he ends up winning the race with the horse that breaks the track record, and I remember getting an email from the publicity director at the time, and Susie Sauerwine, and she said, boy, you couldn't have been more right. It was so great to have such a guy like this that was so cooperative. They had him going to the tailgate party that was in the parking lot to speak, and, I mean, Doug O'Neill went here, there, and everywhere. He's always been that way, so cooperative, and he has stepped up big time to help defend our sport against this onslaught that we've been under this year. So, as you say, major praise to Doug O'Neill for what he's done, not only in terms of his training this year, but especially what he's done off the track. And look, he's the leading trainer at this Santa Anita meet right now by a big margin. He's got 15 victories at the meet, and Phil D'Amato was second with 8. Bob Baffert has 7. So Doug O'Neill, he's had a very good year, but he's having an especially strong Santa Anita fall meet. By the way, how about the jockeys that we look at the top of the standings? Boy, we haven't seen anything like this in recent times. Sadil, the leading jockey with 12 wins. Velez, second in the standings with 11. And then you get Drayden Van Dyke with 8. Evan Roman, he is really kind of having a resurgence, which I'm glad to see. He's got 7, and Bay Hirano has 7. Pratt's been out of town a lot, so that has certainly helped in terms of the other riders ahead of him in the standings, and he has 6. But, boy, it was just kind of interesting when I checked those standings here a couple of days ago, and I go, wow, look at this. Sadio number 1, Velez number 2.
Well, and John, let me slip in something from off the news wires, and Judmont, Prince Khalid, announcing that Enable will stay in training. She's
wonderful.
Not coming for, yeah, she's not coming for Breeders' Cup.
Darn it.
Yeah, she'll stay in
really
training for next year.
She was coming for the Breeders' Cup.
No, she came out of the race well, but they're gonna point for another arc. And they're going to try again. So
wow,
yeah, they will keep her in training.
Well, you talk about sportsmanship.
Yeah, this is nice.
A very sporting gesture. I mean, because look, he doesn't need to be racing her. I mean, he could just as well. I mean, a lot of people didn't expect her to be racing this year, quite frankly, and it was pretty game of them to go for a third arc, and but especially now that she got beat this year, it certainly would have been understandable if she would have retired, you know, to stud. So especially if she had won it, I would have thought. And
yeah,
had won, I would have made it 1-9 that she would have retired.
Well, there you go, and I'm just circulating that for everybody that has not yet seen it. There we go. Send that off into the Twitterverse, as it were. John, beside the weekend action, let's shift our focus toward Breeders' Cup in general. And there's a first reference, of course, with that news that Enable will not come. I'm going to guess that to stay on the turf for a second before we talk Classic and Distaff with John. I'm going to get John's morning line thoughts. Chad Brown told Dave Grenig on Sunday after everybody worked that Bricks and Mortar was making it very difficult on Chad in terms of a decision, and that though with each passing workout and watching it Bricks and Mortar prepare for Cup, he seems to be more inclined to try the turf, and I'm going to wonder aloud if this news doesn't make that decision a little bit easier too, to go ahead and let Bricks try a distance that, based on what Chad is seeing, feels more and more within Bricks and Mortar's scope. So we'll see. But Chad was not any closer to a decision, although he did say, and this is scary, that he thought Bricks and Mortar worked as well as he has all year, and that would essentially mean as well as he's ever worked. So wherever Bricks and Mortar ends up running, he's going to be a handful.
Well, it's kind of surprising since we have so many different Breeders' Cup races that a horse can actually end up in kind of in a middle zone, so to speak. And that's the case with Bricks and Mortar. You know that they would prefer something maybe longer than a mile and shorter than a mile and a half, something in the mile and an eighth, mile and a quarter range on the turf, but they don't have it. And so he's got to go one way or the other. And I have to agree with you 100% that the news with Enable would certainly do nothing to dissuade me from thinking about the turf. I wouldn't be chomping at the bit to run against Enable on firm ground, I can tell you that. So, and that's scary, as you say, for Chad Brown to be making a comment like that about Bricks and Mortar. The only bad thing about Chad Brown is the guy just never hardly ever wins a race on turf. So maybe he can finally step up and win one of these big turf races someplace, because he's had such a trouble winning any kind of graded stakes races on the grass. Most of these races these days, you look at the field and he's got not, I mean, it reminds me of the days in Southern California back in the 70s and the 80s when you'd look at the big races like the Santa Anita Handicap and the Hollywood Gold Cup and so forth, and Charlie Whittingham wouldn't only have just the favorite, he'd have the second favorite and probably the third favorite too a lot of times. So that's sort of the case with Chad Brown, where, I mean, you look at any, like the Queen Elizabeth II Challenge Cup or any of these grass stakes in New York. I mean, so often these days, it isn't just Chad Brown with the favorite. He's got, you know, like two or three of the top runners in a race. So he's just assembled such a powerhouse. And I know that Bobby Frankel would be so proud of what his protege, Chad Brown, has accomplished. But that is the thing that we're sitting in at this time, is the moving parts in terms of the Breeders' Cup as far as who is running and who is running where.
Well, John, let's utilize some of your, and you're going to have to make the line, and so you monitor this as much as anybody. Let's actually start with the distaff first, because this field, and we're waiting on, actually we're waiting on a Chad Brown decision too with Wildcat. He's already got Dunbar Road set, but the field right now is size wise is somewhat limited. I think we're looking at nine right now: Midnight Bisou, Blue Prize, Dunbar Road, Paradise Woods, Serengeti Empress, Secret Spice for Baltus, and I think I saw where John Velasquez picked up the mount on Secret Spice, Street Band for Larry Jones and Sophie Doyle, Ollie's Candy, and Patty Gallagher and the team. They're going to make this a swan song, at least under their ownership, for LaForce, who's going to be sold after Breeders' Cup. And as I mentioned, Wildcat decision pending, and She's a Julie decision pending from Steve Asmussen. But you know, with that base of nine, with the options of the 10th and 11th, John, what do you expect here?
Well, of course, the big key would be if Mott were to all of a sudden decide to run a late there, but he is saying that he's looking at the classic for her, so that's the way we're proceeding at this point. But a late would change the whole situation dramatically. In fact, the whether or not a late ran here would be the difference between what I would probably do at this point with Midnight Bisou, in terms of I would make her an odds-on favorite at this point and would not make her an odds-on favorite if she were to run into, have to face a late in this race, because a late would draw a lot of betting.
Sure.
And don't forget, a late was favored over Midnight Bisou the last time they met, and there was only a nose between them at the finish. And a late gets bet, you know, every time she goes out there, she gets hammered. So, but assuming a late is not in this race, as I say, that then makes Midnight Bisou a very strong favorite in this race to me, especially when you consider she's actually a Horse of the Year candidate. And another dynamic in this race in terms of making the morning line is the field size, and that's something that a lot of people don't realize, that the number of runners in a race, how much you have to divide the pie up, is a key element in terms of what kind of prices you're making on horses. If you got a 6, 7, 8 horse field, You can make a horse, in fact, a lot of the horses, shorter prices than you would if you've got a 12, 13, 14 horse field, and especially 13 and 14. I mean, that it's very hard even just to make a 5 to 2 favorite in a 14 horse field, because then you're having to make too many horses, you know, up there, big prices, and you're just going to leave your neck out on the chopping block, where you're going to make some horse 20 to 1, and all of a sudden this horse is gets a lot of support and comes in there 5 or 6 or something, and you look like a complete idiot. So I would make Midnight, based on the 9 we're looking at here at this point, and again, we don't know how they're going to train, you know, and so forth, but I would make Midnight Bazoo 4 to 5, which would, I would assume, would end up being the shortest price of any of the Breeders' Cup races this year as far as the morning line. And then for second, I would go to Dunbar Road at 5. And then I would make Blue Prize and Paradise Woods each 6. And then we go to Secret Spice at 8. And I would make Serengeti Empress 15. And I would make Straight Man and Ollie's Candy each 20. And I'd make La Force 30. So that would be the line based of those 9 at this time.
Very nice. And let's leave the rest of the field alone. Let's say a late, and a late is going to cross enter.
Yep.
Mott has said that. So let's say, you know, let's say they, for whatever reason, they end up going in this race. What would the two of them be?
Either, and that's a lot harder to line to make all of a sudden, because now I'm going to have to push up a lot of those horses beyond the big two, and as I say, Midnight Bazoo all of a sudden goes from odds on to above even money. I would be inclined at this time, I would be really with my ground of the year, kind of listen to people on your show. I monitor the wagering in Europe and so forth, which we're going to get a better indication from Odds Checker once we get the pre-entries after next week, because that, you know, that'll kind of crystallize things too, to where we have an even better idea of what races horses are looking at. But I would, at this point, look at Midnight Bazoo at 8 to 5. And, you know, a lot of people, I think, are not giving a late the respect that I think she would get in the betting. For instance, you look at the Daily Racing Form line, and they have a late 3. I can't even envision her at 3 myself. So I'd be very inclined to make her 9 to 5, 8 to 5, 9 to 5, because you know, again, when you look at how a late was bet against Midnight Bazoo the last time they met, and it wasn't like, yeah, Midnight Bazoo won the race, but it's not like she won by 3 or something, or 5, or even 1 length. She won by a nose.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a thriller. So, to me, you can't really separate those two too much.
Fair enough.
So, and by making two horses that short a price, now, like, then you're up having to raise horses. So the Blue Prize, Dunbar Road, and Paradise Woods, where I have kind of in that next tier, I'd have to go up to 8 on those. And then you're into the double digits on other horses. For instance, like Secret Spice would go from 8 to like 12. So that would be kind of what I'd be looking at. So honestly, for me as a line maker, I just assume see a late in the classic, because it really makes me, I feel better about making the line in the distaff without a late in it than with her in it.
Fair enough. I love it. And I agreed. I sort of jotting as you were talking, and I wrote, what did I write first? 6 to 5. Or I think I wrote 7 to 5, and then I changed to 7 to 5 and 8 to 5. So 8 to 5 and 9 to 5. I think you're right. I think there's a sheet of paper separating them. Let's turn to the classic, and we have a pretty good likelihood that this field of 10 as it stands right now with a late is going to come together, and unless there's some late additions. And you know, one of the things that everybody's been kind of wondering about is just how much Vino Rosso and Code of Honor after that, you know, highly discussed Jockey Club Gold Cup. You know, how much money at this point they draw away from McKenzie? Because I think, I mean, your inclination still has to be to make McKenzie the favorite.
That is my inclination, but I will tell you, I'm not like locked into it, but that is my thinking at this time, particularly when you look at how he's been bet throughout his career again. And that's one of the things as a line maker that I take into strong consideration, not only the horse's record, but how they've been bet. That is a big barometer because it gives you insight into how they may very well be bet in this race, how they've been bet in the past. And McKenzie has been favored time after time, and you know, in the awesome again, he was a short price favorite. He won't be a short price favorite here, and I'm not even like, I wouldn't want, if somebody said, are you going to bet your life he's going to be the favorite, I'd say not in a million years.
Yeah.
So I mean, because there's a lot of question marks on McKenzie coming off this loss, the mile and a quarter distance. You know, it's no like slam dunk. He'll go be favored when they leave the gate. But as far, this is one of those situations I've articulated to you in the past too. If I'm going to be wrong, how do I want to be wrong? And I don't want to be a wise guy and make like Code of Honor the favorite, and then McKenzie goes off it, you know, happens to get bet heavy like he's capable of doing. You know, this is a case where I'm inclined to make, based on the field that we have right now, I make him 3-1, but he's the type of horse that could get bet down from that 3-1. There's no question. I mean, he could go off at 8-5, 9-5, something like that. I mean, that wouldn't shock me either. On
sure.
The other hand, as I say, it wouldn't shock me if he wasn't even the favorite. So this is kind of a toughie from that standpoint. And then you've got the big question mark in the race. Would Omaha Beach go in here, and that would really pull the rug out on this thing and change it. So, I'm really hoping Omaha Beach, I mean, personally, I'd like to see Omaha Beach in the Classic, but he told you, and as recently as Sunday on Mike Willman's radio show here in Los Angeles, he said that he's inclined to be looking at the sprint, and I think right now that is the direction that they're most likely headed. He's scheduled to have a workout tomorrow. That's going to tell us a lot, too, how far he works, how well he works, and at that point, I'm kind of guessing that Mandela will come out and say, based on this work and because we just don't have enough time to get him ready for a mile and a quarter race, we're going to go to the sprint. So that's kind of what I'm anticipating. And as I say, actually, in terms of crunching the numbers for this Classic, it sure is a lot better to crunch these numbers without Omaha Beach in it than with him in it. As you say, I'm not seeing any kind of big gap between McKenzie and your Jockey Club Gold Cup protagonist. And I would make Code of Honor at this point 7-2, the second favorite, with Vino Rosso 4-1, the third favorite. And I could even, if I start to see a lot of support for Vino Rosso, I could even switch those or even make him co-second favorite. So that's fluid at this point. But I think those are your big three. I think that's pretty clear. I think those are the three that are really the strongest contenders, especially in terms of the betting, how the betting will go. Then beyond that, you got kind of a next tier again, and the three to me in the next tier are a late higher power in Yoshida, and I would be looking at 6-1 on a late and 6-1 on higher power. And personally, I think higher power is horse that could win this race. And I don't want to be a wise guy, because if I have that feeling, I don't want to be. What I hear a lot of line makers do through the country is sometimes they'll say, well, you know, I really like that horse, but I didn't think the public would. Well, I never like to sell the public short. If I can see that higher power is very live in this race, there's a lot of bettors out there that are seeing the same thing that I do, that he stumbled at the start of that awesome again. His race was really kind of thrown into a tither at the start tactically. I mean, it put him much farther back than he should have been. I know how confident Pratt is in him coming out of that race. Pratt just is oozing confidence. And this horse, if you just look at that Pacific Classic, would be good enough to win this race. So you don't want to be going too high on him. And even at 6-1, if I started to kind of feel that a lot of people were hopping on that bandwagon, I could even end up coming down on him from the 6. So he's one I'm really keeping a close eye on, especially since, like I say, I really think he's a strong contender in this race myself. Then I would go, and this is a hard decision on Yoshida. He's kind of a tricky one to put a number on. I mean, to me, he could go as low as 5 or 6. He could go as high as 10 or 12. Honestly, he's kind of a tough one. He's been kind of out of sight, out of mind. He's got that big come-from-behind style. So I feel I'll go with 8 on him, try to keep him in single digits. One of the things I've tried to tell aspiring line makers, there's certain elements that, from a perception standpoint, that you want to always try to keep an eye on. And one of them is single digits and double digits. There isn't much difference, literally, between 8-1 and 10-1. But when you look at it on a tote board, or you look at it at a program, or where to have you, and you have a horse in double digits, and they get bet down into single digit, it accentuates the difference more than it does, say, between 8-1 and 6-1. So I'm always conscious of single-digit, double-digit dynamic when making a line, and I, at this point, would try very hard to keep Yoshida in single digits to protect myself in case he were to get bet pretty good. Then we get into the long shots of the race, including Mongolian Groom. Now, I'll tell you one thing about Mongolian Groom. I've been making him a shorter price than he goes off in the betting pretty much ever since the Santa Anita Handicap, in which he finished third. He's a horse that he just doesn't get much respect. You loved him in the Woodward. It made him your pick in your contest. And look, this horse came back, and that, there was nothing fluky to me about that Awesome Again. If he'd run a 98 buyer or something in that race, I'd kind of say maybe it was a little flukish. 110 buyer tells you that was the real deal that he ran that day, and that number sticks out in this field and puts him, you know, in terms of a chance to win the race. I'm not surprised that they put up the big money to run in this race. They should, honestly, off of that performance.
Why not?
On the same track that the Classic is going to be run.
Yep.
So I'm kind of looking at cutting his price in half is what I have in mind from the 25-1 last time in a small field to 12-1 here. And I'll be honest, I think he very likely would go above the 12
float.
Again. But,
yeah, float up.
But I would make him 12 because I think that's a good area. I think it's in the ballpark. And sometimes you're just, as a line maker, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get in the ballpark on each and every horse. That's why it takes so much time to go through an entire card. You've got to go through this thought process on every single horse that's on the card. And then after him, we get into the real long shots in the race, and that would be Owendale 20, Seeking the Soul 20, and of course, Seeking the Soul, when you get Dallas Stewart at 15, 20, you know, tight prices, he's certainly one to watch out for, especially in terms of the trifecta, superfecta, that he's pulled off a lot of wins through the years with horses that are neglected in the wagering, and it wouldn't like completely shock me if the Seeking the Soul were to run a big race here, but he's getting the perception that Churchill is the track where he runs his best, and he's, you know, his last couple of races, especially the Pacific Classic, were quite disappointing. On the other hand, he was the favorite in the Pacific Classic, but those two recent performances, especially the race in the Awesome Again, where he just really was no factor at 11-1, and he was 11 in that race. And that is a big key to me in what kind of number to make him in this race, because if he was, you know, 6-1 or 5-1 or 4-1 in the Awesome Again, I would not be making him 20 in this race. But because he was 11 and was a well-beaten fourth, it wasn't like he was a close fourth, he was a well-beaten fourth. That's why, you know, and I got to make long shots in here someplace, so he's one of them at 20. War of Will, a horse that I've loved since the spring, but he's just really kind of gone off form since the Preakness. He showed a glimmer of hope in the Pennsylvania Derby, but I don't think the Pennsylvania Derby this year was a vintage edition of the Pennsylvania Derby, especially after Improbable stumbled at the start, kind of threw the race, you know, into a quandary there. So I've got him at 20. I don't think he's going to get bet much. You know, he hasn't been getting, you know, bet real strongly. And then I've got Math Wizard, who pulled off the upset in the Pennsylvania Derby at 30. I would be watching him. There's a chance I could make him 20, but, you know, I think people are going to look at that Pennsylvania Derby and want to say, hey, prove that to me again. I think that will be the approach of most bettors. I think most bettors aren't good. And this is the key, again, of the difference of the buyer speed figure and the margin of victory of Math Wizard versus vis-a-vis Mongolian Groom, where Mongolian Groom won by over two lengths against one of the top horses in the country in McKenzie, and also defeated the Pacific Classic winner in High Power and got a 110 buyer. Math Wizard against only three-year-olds, so a race that wasn't for three-year-olds and up, he wins in a photo and gets it wasn't a triple-digit buyer in the race. So I think, again, against this much tougher competition, I can't expect Math Wizard to get much play here. He'd have to go out there, I think most people will say, and prove it again.
And what about Owendale?
Oh, and Owendale, 20. He was one of the 20, so I meant to say him, but he would be 20, too. And he could. He's one that if the dynamic of the race changes and I have to come up with points somewhere, he'd be a candidate to go to 30. But I'd try very hard not to go to 30 because this again, he's a horse I've had my eye on through the year. Going clear back to that Lexington, that race he made such an electrifying move on the far turn. If you go by the thoroughgraph numbers, his race in the Preakness, he probably was the best horse that day, to be honest. Then he won the Ohio Derby. His Travers is a throwout. He came back and won the Oklahoma Derby. So he is a live long shot in the race, quite honestly. But on the other hand, he's never run a triple-digit buyer again. But on the other hand, it's Brad Cox, and this guy's winning races left and right these days, too. So, you know, there's things to like about Owendale, things to not like. You know, a three-year-old against older, this will be his first start against his elders. So, and, you know, in his one matchup against Code of Honor, he was well beaten. And I think it's a race you can probably draw a line through. But when people start to bet into this race, I don't think, again, they're going to be flocking to Owendale. So I think he will be a big price. And so that's why I've got him listed at 20.
Well, John, no, I appreciate this exercise. We like doing this a couple of weeks out and give everybody a little bit of an idea. Jeremy Plonk is going to swing in here and we'll talk to Jeremy to close out the morning. What's your race again? What are you working on?
For the wager guide, I've always been left out of that request from the standpoint.
We have the cup.
So many Breeders' Cups at Santa Anita that I get so overwhelmed that I just can't have that added onto the plate. So
I hear you.
That has taken me out of the wager guide, unlike for the Triple Crown races. So, but I'll tell you one thing. This happened last year, and I can guarantee it'll happen again this year. I make sure to read the wager guide, not only for all the stats in it, but again to get a feel for what a lot of the people are looking at these races. When I'm making the line, and you heard Johnny D discuss it, that these are people to respect. And I'm always interested in the opinion of people that I respect. That's why when I make the morning line at Santa Anita, I'm looking at various elements in terms of not just the horses, but people like Brad Free, for instance, and his picks and his analysis. Or there's another fella here, Aaron Hess, who's a very good line maker, and he's provided help to me in terms of where I might make a big price on a horse, and he's showing me that I might be off or I've got a horse too low. So Aaron's been invaluable to help to me. I look at Michael Hammersley's pick in the form, and then Bob Mazursky, who's an outstanding handicapper like Aaron Hess, and Brad Free and Michael Hammersley. Bob sends me his handicap that will go into the newspapers, and that's been a very valuable help to me. And that's where I look at the, for instance, with the Breeders' Cup, I'm looking at the odds checker, how these races are being bet in Europe. I'm looking at the racing form rankings. Again, these are people I respect that are doing the work at the racing form. So I want to see how they rank these horses. So, because I'm not just handicapping the horses, I'm trying to handicap how the people are going to see the horses, because that's the key. I'm not trying to predict the outcome of the race. I'm just trying to predict the betting. And if you're trying to predict the betting, you want to get inside the heads of the bettors as much as you possibly can.
John, I appreciate it. We'll certainly get plenty of opportunity in the next couple of weeks to just keep sifting through and trying to pull out those nuggets. And then John's going to have to come up with the actual morning lines for all the races. So we'll talk next week, John. Thanks a lot.
Very good, Steve. Take care. Thanks.
We're going to stay right here. We got about 15 minutes to fill out on a busy Tuesday. Jeremy Plonk, Horse Player Now. And speaking of busy, Jeremy, between Keeneland and the work that you do on the Express Bet wagering guide and the finishing touches on your own kitchen remodel. We're getting started on our kitchen remodel, but you're wrapping up. Good morning.
Hey, I'm just enjoying it and literally dining on the fruits of the labor at this point with that part of it. But, yeah, it is a busy time of year. A couple more weeks of that run-up to the Breeders' Cup. Certainly it all compacts in here. Good racing at Keeneland again this week with, four stakes on the docket over the course of 5 days. And it's going to be exciting times here and a lot of preparation towards the Breeders' Cup. Already starting, race replay review, trying to match up some common opponents. I wrote my blog there at expressbet.com this week about how do you build confidence towards the Breeders' Cup. Know what you know. The circuits you follow, get to know those horses as best you can and play to your strengths. If you're a New York handicapper, know which New York horses are weak, which ones are strong, which ones are overrated, underrated, and really try to attack those races that involve the horses that you know best. That's, one of the key points I think you can do. And the other thing, too, is, pace handicapping. It's too early for that. We've got to see who ends up in the field and where they draw in the gate and things like that. But pace handicapping is like a good defense in football. It travels anywhere, good weather, bad weather, home, away. Pace handicapping is so important, and we'll see how that plays out. But, develop your confidence for Breeders' Cup because you can't play all 14 the same.
You brought up an interesting element when you talk about knowing your circuit and the places that you focus on the most during the course of a betting year. And I would include in that being able to completely neutralize the biases that you typically may have individually about regions and circuits. Don't preclude that, a horse that, shows up. I don't think she's coming, but the Kathleen O'Connell, Stormy Embrace. Don't preclude that horses that ran at Ellis and ran at Presque. I mean, certainly Presque Isle. All you have to do with the filly and mare sprint is look at the parade of success, and go back to that Del Mar 2 years ago with the 1-2 finishers from the Presque Isle Masters, comprising a monstrous exacta. Don't have pre-established biases against horses going into your handicapping of this event.
No, and if there's any place, you say, horse comes from a circuit that I don't have as much respect for, something like that, and I want to put the big red X on him. I agree with you. That's not the right thing to do. I think the quickest big red X you can make in the Breeders' Cup is a horse who's coming off a lousy race. They just don't rebound in the Breeders' Cup. Stands the Arc de Triomphe. You rarely see a horse coming off bad efforts or a bad effort. You got to peak, right? You got 10, 12, 14 horse fields with all the best from all the different corners of the country, including some parts of the world in some of these divisions. You just don't see horses just wake up all of a sudden. It doesn't happen very often. If it does, that's your 70-1 shot, and we're not sitting around waiting on those. You can't bank a card on trying to catch, lightning in a bottle like that. So, in logical handicapping, you try to find the best value among the best contenders. You've got to eliminate the ones who did not come up to the race in good form. And I think that's, one of your first exits to make is, let's just see. And it may not be a bad race per se, it might be a third or fourth place finish, but maybe the horse was 3-5 and ran third, right? He wasn't supposed to run third. You can't find a good viable excuse for it. Did you think this horse has suddenly got it all back together now and you're still going to take a moderate to short price? No, So I think that's what you have to look for. Horses move in the right direction, peaking at the right time. And those are the things you can kind of start to look at now, A lot of folks don't have access to the PPs yet. I know Brist has a set that's out there that people can pick up on the marketplace. And You know, if you're starting to look at horses already in the divisions and past performances are available to you, that's one of the things you can start to look at. You know, start to make some X's and some question marks on horses that maybe are coming off of subpar efforts for them. You know, I mean, third in a grade one may not be a subpar effort, but it might be for that horse.
And, you know, as you say that, and you absolutely provided the right proviso when you mentioned not just the arc, but actually there's a few performances from Longchamp into Breeders' Cups that, you know, that have parlayed into wins. But I'm just kind of thumbing through an old...
I think that with European racing, the way the races are run in Europe and the clump finishes and the slow paces and the gaps, and if you look at any good horse in Europe, I mean, other than the greats, I mean, Franco ran off the numbers and things like that, and Enable, but most of the European horses, you're going to see a lot of fifth and sixth place finishes, even amongst Group 1-type horses. I mean, they just kind of run that way. So, you know, those are, yeah, definitely more forgivable. But, you know, when you're handicapping the American horses, an American horse who finished third, fourth, or fifth and was supposed to finish better, those are the kind you got to really worry about right now.
Yeah, I mean, the misalleged in the 91 turf. She was fifth in the arc, and she was part of the field at 42-1.
I think that was Bob Neumeier's greatest hit, if I recall. I think that was
misalleged. This is
nice. That might have been it.
I love it. Well, I'm you got me. You got me doing something interesting. That's a tremendous point. You know, there. I love it. I'm glad you threw that in there. And of course, there'll be tons of that kind of thing in the wagering guide. Johnny hit a few today as well, earlier this morning. Jeremy, let's get a few. And obviously, over the next 2 weeks, 3 weeks, we're going to visit regularly, and we'll hit your thoughts as the fields come together. Let's get some Keeneland work in, though, and what went on since we spoke last week, and of course the Queen Elizabeth and Oleksandra in that thrilling late run to spoil Morticia's career finale.
Well, we talked about that, and I think this time slot last week. You know, we had the entries all ready for that, and we mentioned what a great turf sprint rider Joel Rosario was closing up the fence, and just how that race would play out. And sometimes they run to the way that they project and look, and that one certainly did. And a big effort from Oleksandra. She's really a good turf sprinter and got the trip, and Joel got her the trip. And he is just elite finish. And I think on Sunday that he won the turf sprint up at Belmont, he's just an elite rider in the turf sprint races. You know, he hasn't always had a lot of mounts in the turf sprint race either at Breeders' Cup time. But if you look at his record in that race, he's got an outstanding record, top four finishes almost throughout when he rides in the Breeders' Cup turf sprint. So whoever Joel Rosario ends up on Breeders' Cup day is something, one of these lessons you can learn from, you know, look, hey, I follow my circuit. This is what I talk about, right? And if I follow Keeneland, I know what a great turf sprint jockey Joel Rosario is. If you follow New York, you know that too, because, you know, that he rides both places. But those are the kind of things I'm talking about. And so now I'm looking, okay, where will Joel end up in the Breeders' Cup turf sprint? This might be, you know, an angle that I can lean on and something that's been successful for me playing the individual meet. The other stakes this weekend, you know, at Keeneland, the Queen Elizabeth II, as a gambler, just so unsatisfying that you have such a difficult race. They all look the same on paper in the 9-to-5 shot wins, you know? I mean, nothing against Cambier Park or anybody who backed her, you know? It's just one of those races where he said, man, I could go 5-6 deep in this 8-horse field and spread my wings. In fact, I played a single, like 5-by-4 in the late pick four, and I had Fast Boat, was on with Dave and Dick Girardi on their show on Sirius that day on Saturday, and said Fast Boat was my best bet of the day, and got that one. And then the favorite, the Brad Coxworth, ran second in the next race. So I didn't get the two singles to the last two. Just the way that's set up, I thought the Queen Elizabeth II Challenge Cup was a much more competitive race than it turned out to be. Cambier Park, what a good ride by John Velasquez. I mean, that was one of those races where we said you try to do pace projection, right? There was no speed in the race. Chad had three of them. I thought the horse on the outside that he had coming out of the Saratoga race would go to the front. That one broke outward at the start under Ortiz, And then, you know, Johnny just said, okay, well, I'll just take the front and go. And he went with it with Cambria Park. And, you know, again, a race sets up the way it looks on paper. It was going to be won by a horse on the front end. You just didn't expect Cambria Park to be the one
no.
who went to the front. But
nope.
she did, and she was. You weren't catching her once she got up there and got comfortable. And Johnny, you know, motored her home. She really ran a nice race. But like I said, just from a gambler standpoint, unsatisfying in that, you know, that looked like a race where you could get a really nice horse at $12, $13, and it just didn't happen.
Well, there was more than one, and I absolutely agree that that it was it was the other one of Chad's that that I thought was more tactical, and I keyed off of Castle Lady, who you know ranged up and chased Cambier Park home, and the I even found the right price, Princess Carolina for
Carolina
for McPeak. I botched a bunch of things. I had the cross country pick five was absolutely they were all there and I really built a bad series of tickets. I paid $660 and it was there was not one horse in there that was mysterious. I mean I just was shaking my head. I couldn't wait for the day to end.
Yeah, when you look from the airplane view of this team, the meet, it doesn't look that difficult. You know, the prices are decent. There hasn't been a lot of total, you know, head scratchers other than a couple opening weekends. You know, there hasn't been a huge run of favorites like we saw in the spring where favorites hit almost 50% on the dirt. It's not that case, you know, but they're tough to string together. And Kate and Brando and I were talking about this the other day on the phone before we recorded our podcast. I was like, well, how you doing? And she says, I just can't get anything consecutive together. And I'm like, I'm in the same boat. You know, you catch one, you can't catch two. I'm still kicking myself in the ass for, you know, playing the biggest play I made in the meet is because I love Maxfield in the Breeders' Futurity. I thought rushing Paul to Maxfield in the double, you'll probably end up with triple the price you would get on Maxfield to win. And all you got to do is get rushing Paul 6-for-6 at Keeneland, right? I mean, she's won five. So it didn't work out that way. And then when the race comes up, instead of 12-to-1 in the morning line on Maxfield, you got half that price. And all of a sudden, what could have been a weekend maker, you know, just hitting a double a bajillion times, just turns out to be a, yeah, okay, it's 6-to-1, and I didn't catch the gimmicks within that race, you know. So they're hard to string together. But when you look at each race and you see, you know, these California guys are here now. That makes Keeneland has always been the melting pot, right? I always call it the 16-day melting pot. In the fall, it's the 17-day melting pot. But now with the Californians here, you got a lot of D'Amato's running. You're getting Bob Hess horses running here. You know, Richie Baltus has had a good amount in there. So you get that New York Kentucky blend to start with. Now you're throwing some California in, and you know, you're getting four or five decent options with which to pick in each race, and you still got to come up with them, you know. There's just not a lot you can circle and put an underline through. Mike Maker, interestingly, had lost 19 races in a row until he won with his last mount or with his last horse that he sent out on Sunday. He won two opening day, and you're like, wow, Maker's going to be off to a great start this meet. Then he lost 19 in a row, and then he snapped it like by 1-for-20 then by winning with his last race on Sunday. And he's got a couple horses, you know, early in the week here that look pretty good on paper. So will Maker turn the corner? It's going to be interesting. Florent Giroux being injured, I think, makes a big deal in the jockey colony because, look, he's first call rider for Brad Cox and Mark Cassie. A lot of times he rides first call for. These are the two guys who typically battle for the title. You know, if Maker's cold at one for his last 20 and Cox and Cassie are fishing around for different riders now, it's going to be interesting. I think that's a big deal to the riding colony. It looks to me like Joel Rosario has picked up the Brad Cox horses based on the early entries that we can tell from that after Giroux was hurt on Sunday when they entered for Thursday. Since then, or Friday, it looks to me like Joel Rosario may be the benefactor of picking up some of these mounts. So keep an eye on that over the last 2 weeks.
Well, and over the last 2 weeks includes, we got the Sycamore on Thursday. We've got a lot of maiden races, a lot of two-year-old and a couple of two-year-old allowances again. One name I'm going to throw out that has really had a good year overall, partly on the strength of his summer at Saratoga, Phil Sims. Who sent out that Sky Mesa winner, Royal Mesa, in the nightcap on Sunday at a fat 20-to-1. And how about Grant Forster, gotta love it. Grant ringing the bell more than a couple of times at Keeneland.
Yeah, you know, and sometimes when you get, you know, the names that every, like I said, there's four or five, like, name options in every race. And when you get beyond the names, I mean, I know it's horse handicapping, but the names matter in the tote board. And, you know, you can get some of these trainers that people don't necessarily follow so much, the Forsters and Phil Sims at big prices. So handicap the horses is very good advice. There's no doubt about it. But you have to understand that the names are going to affect the tote board a lot. Steve, want to throw a quick stat lookout for people coming up at Keeneland over the next couple of days. I'm going to give you a quick trivia. What Breeders' Cup champion, his offspring, have won six of the last eight dirt routes they've attempted at Keeneland? Sire. Six of the last eight times they've run in a dirt route, they've won at Keeneland.
Six Breeders of Cup the champion. Last? Street Sense.
That. Midnight Loot, believe it or not.
And love two, Midnight Loot.
And he's got two dirt routers in this week coming up at Keeneland. I've looked at the Wednesday card so far. He's got California Night in the second, going 1/16 on Wednesday. And then he's got one in the front half of the card on Thursday. I haven't finished handicapping the Thursday card. That's what I'm going to do when I hang up here. So Midnight Loot's got a couple in there. Six of the last eight dirt routes at Keeneland is offspring of one. You would not expect it. I did not know that, as Dana Carvey used to say.
Well, take your mare to Midnight Loot. $15,000 next year at Hill and Dale. So make it happen. He's one of our absolute favorites. He's totally underrated. Just all he does is get runners, and all horseplayernow.com does is help you find winners. Jeremy, thanks so much. We'll talk next week.
All right, buddy. Take care.
JP, and you read, you know, his analysis, not just the picks, but those breakdowns are so much fun. Read it at the Keeneland website. Thanks to Kevin Attard, Mike Keogh, Johnny D, Guy Torsiglieri, John White, Jeremy Plonk, Deja on the board. Talk to you tomorrow.